Today is, let's see, it's not Saturday. Today is Sunday, November 22nd, 2020. This is a Part 8 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Carl. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing real well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. In the last bit of Part 7 interview, you'd mentioned that Christmas Eve, 1986, you're being boxed up and you're moving from Grand Canyon to a new job at Petrified Forest National Monument. Or no, National Park, sorry. I'll get it right eventually. And your job is the resource management specialist. And
that's right.
Can you pick that up for us?
Okay. Well, and I think I mentioned I showed up and everybody was on their Christmas break and their use or lose time, so it gave me a chance to get kind of settled into the office before everybody showed up and the work started. And so it was the position I was in was actually a career ladder position where I came in as a GS, I came in as a GS-7 and then provided that I had performed adequately in my position and they did the right paperwork, I would automatically be advanced to a GS-9.
Oh, wow.
In that position.
Okay.
So finally after over 10 years in the National Park Service, bouncing around seasonally, I was finally on kind of the escalator moving up the ladder. Is that a mixed metaphor?
Moving up.
So I came in and, you know, I had wanted to get into a resource management position.
Okay.
And like I mentioned in the, in our last segment, I'd been trying to pick up information. I had been working, doing, I guess you could say, volunteer work with different researchers at Petrified Forest during my furlough and my days off at Grand Canyon. I'd been auditing some classes at Albright, picking up bits and pieces of different aspects of resource management, and so, you know, I've been wanting to be a resource manager, and now I suddenly was one.
Cool.
So it was expected that especially that first year that I was there would be a real learning experience for me in terms of rounding out my education, figuring out what my responsibilities were, and that sort of thing.
Sort of a real on-the-job training.
Exactly.
Okay.
And my supervisor, Chris Andrus, was the chief ranger for the park, and he was very interested in resource management as well. He was, like I think I mentioned before, he was really, really involved in the various research projects that were going on in the park and that sort of thing. And
and Chris's last name is spelled A-N-D-R-E-S?
E-S-S.
E-S-S. Was he,
yeah.
Was he, as chief ranger, was he law enforcement, or had that been defined out that that much? And was he sort of chief ranger and he was ranger over everybody and wasn't specifically law enforcement?
Yeah, he was, you know, he was commissioned.
Okay.
Had a law enforcement background. But
so he's kind of an exceptional guy if he's really looking to resource management this way.
Yeah, well, and at that time, you know, it still wasn't quite as divided up as things are today in the National Park Service.
Okay.
So it was, Petrified Forest was at a size where the chief ranger was actually in charge of law enforcement, resource management, and interpretation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So pretty much unless you were the superintendent, if you were wearing a Class A uniform, you work for the chief ranger.
Okay.
And so we had, you know, we had a division of administration, whatever. I don't remember. I think our division was called resource. I think ours was, I can't remember what the division was called. And then there was the maintenance division.
Okay.
So I came on the job, and when things started working, Chris took me on a tour of the park, not so much because I needed to know my way around, but kind of some of the things that he was thinking about in terms of what my job responsibilities would be. And
that's
so
neat.
We talked about the paleontological and the archaeological research that was going on.
Okay.
I knew a lot of the researchers from my previous work there. One thing that was kind of new for me was we went to this little shed out on the rim of the Painted Desert, which I had known nothing about, and opened up the door, and here's all this high-tech looking equipment. And he says, "This is our air quality monitoring station."
Wait. Stop right there.
Okay.
A little shed. What did the little shed look like? Like a little outhouse or what?
It was bigger than an outhouse, but not much.
Okay.
It was
6x6 kind of thing, or 10x10?
I'd say either 6x6 or 8x8.
Little slanted roof?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Just a little, it was insulated.
Okay.
The equipment inside had to be kept at a certain temperature.
Oh.
And but it was
And solar panel, battery powered?
Sort of thing. What's that?
Sorry, solar panel, battery powered?
No. It was, we were on a, the at that point, old Route 66, before the days of Interstate 40. Old Route 66 touched the rim of the Painted Desert for about a mile, just inside the what's now the entrance of Petrified Forest National Park.
Okay.
And it ran across, it ran across a little narrow neck. There was the Painted Desert off to the north, and then to the south, there were some little badland gulches. And there was this one flat spot that ran between the two of them, and so that's where they put Route 66. But when it came time to build I-40 wasn't going to fit there, and so
okay.
They moved it about a mile to the south, and old Route 66 just became kind of a service road there in the park. But the old phone lines, the power lines, all ran along old Route 66 through there.
Okay.
So it was just a little shed, but it had power and phones. Or I'm trying to think, did it have? No, it didn't have phones. It didn't have a telephone. It just had power.
Okay.
And here's all this high tech equipment. Chris says, "This is your this is the air quality monitoring station," and it's one of your responsibilities, and it's not working. You'll have to figure out how to make it work.
Wow. Well, let's stop right here for a minute. Do you know when the Park Service got into monitoring for air quality?
It would depend where you were. So, like at Grand Canyon, they were monitoring air quality back in the 1950s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Petrified Forest, let's see, I think that their station was only installed like a year previous, less than a year before.
Okay.
I think that it had maybe been in there for 6 months. In the late 70s and especially in the early 1980s, the air quality had become kind of an issue. There was the Clean Air Act of 1977 amendments, and just to digress, I guess, kind of lay some background.
Please.
the initial Air Quality Act went way back. I think the first law was passed in the 1950s. 56 sticks in my head a little bit.
Okay.
But then during the Nixon administration, they passed what's now known as the Clean Air Act. And it basically said, okay, we want the air to be breathable. We want clean air for the people of the United States to breathe.
Right.
And so the Clean Air Act set up a system where the Environmental Protection Agency was supposed to set standards for how clean air had to be before it was, if it was worse than that, it would be unhealthy for people. And so that was what the original Clean Air Act did. And then people started realizing, there's a lot of parts in the country where the air isn't unhealthy to breathe, but we don't want all the air in the United States to be degraded to the point that you're just barely not going to get sick by breathing it. And so in 1977, the Clean Air Act was amended, and it set up a series of classifications. There were Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 air quality areas, and then non-attainment areas. And the bottom of the pile, non-attainment, was usually urban areas, but places where the air wasn't healthy, and it had to be cleaned up.
Like near a factory or something? Or?
Or like the Los Angeles Basin or things like that.
I see.
And then the Class 1 areas were supposed to have the cleanest air quality. And what they did was a baseline would be established. Baseline wasn't just automatically, some scientifically determined number or anything like that. Instead, what happened was when some facility came in and said, okay, we want to build a factory, we want to build a power plant, whatever, they had to analyze the air quality impacts. And so they would measure the existing air quality where they wanted to establish their facility. And that became a baseline. And then in a Class 1 area, the amount of additional pollution above that baseline to be permitted was very small. In a Class 2 area, the increment allowed was larger. And then a Class 3 area, you'd be allowed to degrade the air quality right down to those health standards.
Wow. So basically, Class 1 areas were to be kept clean, but Class 3 areas could get worse.
Right. All of them could get worse. Class 1 could only get a tiny bit worse. Class 2 could get more worse. And Class 3 could get as bad as would still protect human health.
What's the rationale for that?
Areas that were below the health standards, dirtier than the health standards.
What was the rationale for that?
Basically, it was a kind of a, we want to allow continued development, but at the same time, we want to manage how bad we're going to allow the air to get. And the second part of it was, the second part of the equation was that we had these classifications, Class 1, Class 2, Class 3, and non-attainment. And then the system that was set up was that Congress would set the goal. The goal is healthy air, and there are some other goals in there, too, that I'll get to in a minute. But then the EPA was tasked with coming up with the numeric values for achieving those goals. So lots of times, on the weather, even today, you'll hear the air quality is good, moderate, unhealthy for sensitive groups, unhealthy for the public, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
EPA is the one that sets the numbers for what constitutes unhealthy for the general public. But then to preserve or improve air quality, the Clean Air Act says that is the responsibility of the states and the tribes.
Oh.
Under the Clean Air Act, states and tribes are equivalent to each other.
Okay.
So you have this system that kind of rolls down from Congress's general goals to the states and tribes being responsible for actually implementing those goals.
And was there funding included in this to the states and tribes to sort of help improve air quality?
I know that EPA had funding, but I don't know how they received it and how they divvied it up.
Okay.
I know that the National Park Service got some, and so that's where we get to why Petrified Forest or Grand Canyon had air quality. Was when Congress set up the program and passed it on down to the states, they gave the states the ability to move parcels of land from one category to another. So they said, our baseline is that the entire United States is class 2, the moderate increase in pollution levels, except for national parks and wilderness areas in existence in 1977, greater than 5,000 acres. And those areas are what we call mandatory class 1 areas.
Oh, wow.
They have to manage them as a class 1 area. In other words, the strictest controls on additional pollution levels. So Petrified Forest, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, you know, these big parks and big wilderness areas like the Gila Wilderness or in closer to us, Sycamore Canyon, were also mandatory Class 1 areas. The
okay.
state of Arizona had to manage them as Class 1 areas. They couldn't redesignate them. The states could designate other areas as Class 1 if they wanted to. And some states have done that. Arizona, as far as I know, never has. And states were also allowed, with due public process, to redesignate Class 2 areas as Class 3. In other words, yeah, we want to let this big factory come in and make the air just as dirty as it can without making you sick. And as far as I know, no state has ever redesignated an area to Class 3. So we have this three-part system, and Petrified Forest and Grand Canyon both were mandatory Class 1 areas. The state of Arizona had no choice. They had to enforce these strict limits. And as the coup de grace or whatever, the Clean Air Act amendments in 77 also said that Congress establishes as a national goal the removal of any human-caused visibility impairment from mandatory Class 1 areas.
Wait, so, run that past me again.
Okay. So you're not supposed to have any visibility impairment, in other words, smog, human-caused haze, in mandatory Class 1 areas.
Well, I was thinking of visibility impairment. Sorry, I was thinking of visibility impairment as light pollution or.
This would be at an extreme case, like the brown cloud.
Okay. Okay.
Or over Page. That's a tricky one because there are some air pollutants for which there are standards like ozone that don't impair visibility. I mean, there could be so much ozone in the air that you could take a breath and drop dead, but it wouldn't violate the visibility standard because it's clear. You
okay.
can see right through it. But then there are other pollutants and actually a number of other pollutants, especially particulate matter, that long before you get to pollution levels that are high enough to make you sick, to impair human health, long before you get to that stage, they've already created a real thick murk in the air. So
interesting.
So at Petrified Forest, since that's where I started out, we were monitoring particulates because of visibility impacts, because of that part of the Clean Air Act, and we were monitoring ozone because of the health implications.
And are those two different machines to do that?
Yes. And actually there's a number of different ways of measuring it. So at Petrified Forest, we had and Grand Canyon as well. The most common way of measuring ozone is by shining ultraviolet light through it. And in the world, ozone soaks up ultraviolet light.
Okay.
And there's actually an ozone layer up in the stratosphere that absorbs the ultraviolet light coming in from the sun.
Right.
And so that's good. That we like the ozone up there. Keeps us all from getting skin cancer quite so fast.
Right.
But the ozone molecule is a real reactive molecule. And that's why it absorbs the ultraviolet light. When it's down close to the surface of the Earth, it's very reactive, and it tends to, like, rip up your lung tissue and stuff like that.
Oh, interesting.
And so, like, when your eyes water because of the smog in Phoenix or that sort of thing,
right,
that's the ozone that's doing that.
Mm.
So we're monitoring ozone, and the way you do it is just like the Earth's atmosphere does it. You shine an ultraviolet light through there, and you measure how much the ultraviolet light dims going through your air sample, and that tells you how much ozone's in there.
Okay.
And simple in concept, a little bit more difficult in practice, but, you know, that's the general gist of it.
Hey, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Let's back up a bit. So Chris takes you on a tour. He says, mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, there's a little shack over here you need to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, someone else set that up and got it running,
mm-hmm.
and then left the park. And it got me thinking about talking about tangents, another little tangent here, of the lack of institutional memory or the ability to, I'm hoping that you're going to say, yeah, well, then I found Fred's write-up of, you know, all the previous data and why the system was broken and what needed to be done to fix it so that we could continue on with this long-term record of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fred being the, or whoever, Jane, whoever the person was who had the thing up and running. Were you able to find those records of the person or people who had this up and going before you?
What I got was a phone number.
Oh,
the Park Service, even today, the routine air quality monitoring that's done in national parks is all part of a network, national network, and it's run by the Washington Office of the Park Service, the Air Resources Division, which is part of the whole natural resource program. And their goal all along is to be determining what air pollutants should be measured, and then measuring those air, you know, and that's on a park by park basis. You know, what are the issues facing that park, and what are the issues facing the area, and then setting up a monitoring program that's operated the same across the whole system so that you know that the data is A, you know how it's being collected, B, you know it's being collected properly, and C, you can compare the data from one site to another because you know that they were come up with in the same way.
Okay.
And a good example of that is when you're doing ozone monitoring, you also have to monitor meteorology. You have to monitor the weather, because if the wind is blowing, you want to know, you know, okay, if the wind blows from this direction, do we have more ozone? That helps you identify the source of it. If it's raining, that's going to wash the ozone out of the air. And so consequently, you want to know when it's raining and that sort of thing. And so it's not just the ozone monitoring machine, but it's this other monitoring that goes with it. Well, one of the things that we had at both Petrified Forest and Grand Canyon, same story in both parks, the meteorological system, for example, has a rain gauge. And the rain gauge has a little screen in it that basically keeps bugs and leaves and that kind of stuff out of the rain gauge. And it also keeps snow out of the rain gauge, which is not a good thing because you want to be capturing that snow.
Oh.
So there's a day every year in the fall where we would go out and we would take the leaf, we call it the leaf guard, we take the leaf guard out of the rain gauge. And then in the spring, there was a day when we would go out and we'd put the leaf guard back in again. And we never had leaves in our leaf guard. Yeah, there was no reason for the leaf guard to be there.
Hmm.
But all the parks that were monitoring ozone have a leaf guard. And at Shenandoah National Park, it made a big difference whether the leaf guard was there or not.
Interesting, okay.
And so
they were trying to do
We're all working to do exactly the same thing in all these different parks.
But when I think of Petrified Forest and I think of air quality, there's a highway right there, a very busy national highway.
Mm-hmm.
And in three directions, if not four, there are large coal-fired power plants. There's a nearby town that burns wood for heat. I mean, just trying to think of some of the local pollutant generators that on certain days might show up on your machine.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we were trying to figure out.
Okay.
And we could do that. There were some things. What we were looking to get, and it's always a balancing act when you're monitoring air quality. If you're looking for a specific, if you're looking at a specific source, ideally, at Petrified Forest, one of the things we were concerned about was that big Cholla power plant, the big coal fire plant over in Joseph City.
Right.
And so ideally, what we would do is we would shut down Interstate 40, we'd move everybody out of Holbrook, we'd close the park so that the only thing going was the power plant, and then we'd see what the impact was. Well, obviously, you can't do that.
Right.
And so that's where all this other meteorological monitoring is so important, is that it helps you start teasing out, what are the weather conditions that are associated with very clean air or very dirty air?
Interesting.
And then you combine that with even more extensive meteorological monitoring that says, okay, the wind was blowing from the west, but that particular air mass hit North America and Central Oregon and then came down the west side of Nevada and blah, 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 blah. And so it gets pretty complicated pretty quick. So
yeah, and there's not a lot of days when the wind is blowing from the east, from Cholla. But then you also had me think, oh yeah, there's wood fired stoves there in park housing.
Mm-hmm.
That's gonna increase the particulate matter in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, lots of contributing factors suddenly.
Right. Right, and that's where, when you're doing the particulates, which we were also doing, that was something that we did, was we didn't just collect the particulates in bulk. We had specific ways of capturing specific types of particulates out of the air. So we had the basic setup. It's essentially a vacuum cleaner. You have air pumps that are pulling air through at a calibrated rate, so you know how much, what the volume of air that you're sampling is. And we would sample 2 days a week. Initially it was every third day, and then we changed it to 2 days a week. One filter that we used was Teflon. Teflon, because it doesn't react. It's pretty inert. And so it's whatever particles you capture are not going to react with the filter itself. And to get to the Teflon filter, you pull the air through a stack, and the stack fed down into it got you up above the ground level. They were I'm thinking the inlets were like 4 meters up, but I'm not positive about that.
Okay, so there would have been a big pipe sticking out of the top of this shed.
Right, right. And the air would come down through that pipe, and then it would go into a cyclone, where the air was forced to make some real quick bends, and it was specifically designed so that particles larger than your target size, in this case, 2.5 microns, 2.5 millionths of a meter in diameter. If a particle was bigger than that, it couldn't make it around the tight bends. It would hit the sides of the pipe and fall out into a little collection cup that we dump out every now and then. And so then these little 2.5 micron or smaller particles would then be whisked up and be trapped on the filter. And so the first filter was a Teflon filter, and it would just catch, you know, everything. It was pure white when we received it, and they would measure each filter before they sent it out to us. The contractor on that one was the University of California at Davis. They would measure that filter with lasers to see how white it was.
Wow.
And then we would send the filter back, and the first thing they do is measure it again and see how dirty it had gotten, just, you know, how gray,
okay,
how dark the filter was. So that would be an indicator of partially of the pollutant load. They would weigh the filter before and after to see what the weight of the particles was. And then they would put the particle in a neutron beam, which would cause different elements to fluoresce. And in theory, the filters could be analyzed for any element lighter than uranium.
Huh.
And it would tell you how much of that element was on the filter. In real life, we didn't analyze for every element lighter than uranium. There were specific ones that we were interested in.
Okay.
So that was the first stage. The second stage, there was a filter, and what we were after was sulfates and nitrates, they're combustion byproducts. Sulfates are caused by burning sulfur. Nitrate, they come from high-temperature, high-pressure combustion. The reason we were concerned about them, the nitrates, the high-temperature, high-pressure combustion is basically what a car does.
Okay.
And so, that was, you know, a good indicator of vehicular pollution. Nobody that I know of burn sulfur for fun, but sulfur is an impurity in a lot of fuels, especially coal.
Exactly.
And also diesel. And so the sulfates that we would capture would be a good indication of a coal or diesel source.
Huh.
The reason we were interested in those in particular was because they had a huge impact on visibility. The particular particles are capable of absorbing water out of the atmosphere and growing in size. And so you can get a sulfate or a nitrate particle. It can soak up moisture out of the atmosphere and become even more effective at creating haze.
Hmm.
So long before these guys are any threat to human health at all, they create a lot of haze.
Okay.
And they were one of our big bugaboos. They were the source of most of the haze that we had problems with.
So I'm going back to Chris again. He says, hey, there's this box over here I want to show you, and it isn't working, and you need to make it work. I'm assuming then that the Washington office would have sent him some sort of notice saying, hey, your unit's not working.
Yep.
Fix it.
And he would have said, yeah, we've got somebody coming on.
Got it.
And so I get the phone number, and you know, I had picked up a lot of the legal stuff, the Clean Air Act stuff, and all that sort of thing, auditing classes at Albright while I was still up at Grand Canyon.
Okay.
But the actual mechanics of operating a monitoring system, and the numeric values and that kind of stuff, I didn't know.
And the filters and the screens and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so it's kind of like, okay, this sounds kind of important. I guess I need to get on this.
Huh.
And so we do our tour and we see some other stuff. But that was kind of the biggie. And so shortly thereafter, I'm out at the station. Making notes of stuff and what the machines are saying and all that kind of stuff. And then I go back to the office and call the phone number I had and say, well, what did the ozone analyzer say? And I said, oh, it said, you know, 423. I don't know. Is that a reasonable number? And the guy in Denver says, the Washington office in terms of air quality was in Denver. The guy in Denver says, well, I don't know. Are you dead? So basically, I would, well, eventually I wound up breaking down the station and bringing it into my office so I could talk to him on the phone while I was working on the equipment.
Oh, wow.
But I would literally... I'd be taking these notes, go back to the office, say, okay, this is what it's doing. He'd say, okay, go try this. And I'd go back up and try that. And this was all actually fairly new for the Park Service as well. You know, there'd been monitoring going on in national parks. Like I said, Grand Canyon started in the 50s. But the Park Service was just first starting out with setting up this nationwide network of monitoring stations. And there were a lot of bugs to work out, and their goal was eventually to come up with a system that, you know, that some interpreter or some patrol ranger or whatever could have a manual and go in and do what needed to be done over the course of about an hour, once or twice a week, and then go about their business. And the data would pour into the Washington office, and they could handle it. But they were a long way from that goal at that point.
Hmm.
And so it was kind of tricky to get the system up and running at Petrified Forest. But eventually we did. And I actually was I actually was training some of the rangers, and eventually got to the point where a lot of the routine work on the air quality systems that we had could be done by the patrol folks. Then we started becoming a test bed for other equipment that they wanted to put in different places.
Oh, wow.
And they would test it out at Grand Canyon and have me take care of it, and then see what needed to be fixed. One of them was an instrument called the transmissometer, and it's a visibility measuring device, and it's basically two telescopes looking at each other. One of them has a light in it, and the other one has a light detector in it, and you know exactly how bright the light is when it leaves the transmitter. You measure how bright the light appears when it gets to the receiver, and then you can figure out how hazy the air is between the two of them.
Hmm.
And kind of like the ozone analyzer, there's a lot that goes into that doing it, but they wanted to put one up at Grand Canyon because of issues with the Navajo Generating Station.
Okay.
Up in Page, but they wanted to shoot it across the Grand Canyon. They'd already experimented with lasers and found out that lasers didn't work because a laser beam is so tight that if it hits an inversion, it just bounces off altogether.
Oh, wow.
And even though you can see through the inversion, the laser beam can't get through the inversion in a straight line, and you can't measure it at the other end.
Wow.
So instead they're using just regular old incandescent lights. They were the kind of light that would be used in a slide projector or something like that. A bright light. And but they couldn't really experiment it with it at the Grand Canyon the way they wanted to, because they wanted to shoot from the north rim to the south rim.
Right.
But to test it, they wanted to have somebody that could access both ends so they could troubleshoot. And so they set up one at Petrified Forest because they could get a similar light path, but set it up in a place where somebody, i.e. me, could get to both ends of the instrument and fiddle around with it.
Hmm.
And
I'm sorry, how do you spell the name of this machine?
Oh, transmissometer?
Yeah.
TransmissoMeter.
Thank you. And this is, again, I can imagine if I have a light source,
mm-hmm.
and I'm 10 miles away, let's say, or 12, with a some sort of telescope, I ought to be able to see that light source.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just the simple concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's something, smoke or whatnot, between the light source and the telescope that's looking at it 10 miles away, you wouldn't necessarily see the light.
Yeah, it's one where the, and that's why I say it's more complicated.
Hmm.
The light is being measured at a specific wavelength, and it's chopped up, so the light actually flickers on and off, and the receiver knows to look for that light of that wavelength flickering,
huh.
and measure that. And so, you know, I could stand next to the transmitter, and with a flashlight, and shine it at the receiver, and the receiver would ignore the flashlight. Unless I was turning the flashlight on and off 60 times a second. that works up to a certain point. You can't point it at the sun.
Okay.
That'll break it.
Yeah.
but even if the light is too dim for my eye to pick it up, the receiver is sensitive enough to pick it up. The trick with the transmissometer is that you always want to be able to see the light from the other end. You want to be able to see it getting brighter or dimmer depending on the pollution levels. But if you don't see it at all, then you don't know anything.
Right.
So So as you go from place to place, like out in the West, where our air is clean, our transits on our light paths can be, 6 miles long or something like that. You go back in the eastern United States, and the light path might only be a mile and a half,
Wow.
because if it's longer than that, you start losing the light too much.
Wow. Okay.
So,
So what did you find? What did the air quality surveys at Petrified tell you about the air there?
well, the one thing we were hoping to do was to ascertain if there was any impact on us from the Cholla power plant over there in Joe City. And we were never really able to nail that down. We saw impacts that likely resulted from them, but it wasn't enough for us to be able to take action about it. And that's one where, again, it's a weird setup. The National Park Service is under the Clean Air Act as the land manager of a Class One area. It's our responsibility to protect our resources from the impacts of air quality. But the Clean Air Act doesn't give the Park Service any authority
Huh.
over sources of air pollution. And so what we had to do is something I always referred to as management by whining. We'd find an impact. We'd say, "Oh, this is not good. We've got haze, or we've got an ozone exceedance, or whatever the issue is. We need to do something about this." So then we have to go to the state of Arizona, convince them that there's a problem, and convince them to take action on it.
Oh, wow.
And it gets even more complicated if the source is on an Indian reservation, because the tribes have the authority under the Clean Air Act to manage their own air quality, but a lot of tribes don't do it. In fact, most tribes don't do
Okay.
it. And so if the tribe's not doing it, then the EPA is responsible for doing it. And so it gets to be, one person used to refer to the Clean Air Act as the subtitled the Full Employment for Lawyers Act.
Oh boy.
At the time I was working with it was the second longest law on the books in the
Wow.
United States after the tax code.
Wow.
So it was pretty complicated, but at Petrified Forest, it wasn't a burning issue. We were concerned about the impacts from the Cholla power plant, but we weren't, aside from visibility degradation, we weren't seeing any other impacts to park resources from it. So getting that air quality station up and running was a part of my job, and sometimes, especially when it wasn't working right, it could really consume a lot of time, but it wasn't one of my prime focuses at that
Okay.
particular time.
Just before we leave this, because we're going to move on here, one of the major pollutant generators I would think of would be the LA Basin, west of, well, on the I-40 corridor all the way to, due west. Did you see that in your air quality at all? Could you pin that down with the weather when the winds are out of the west?
It would show up. The other big thing that we were concerned about was the copper smelters in southern Arizona
Oh.
and northern Mexico, because they were copper ore has a lot of sulfur in it,
Right.
and so they would produce those sulfates that were a problem. It was right about that time, though, that they were starting to clean those up. And to be honest with you, Petrified Forest, I didn't get very much involved with what happened to the data. I was very much involved in making sure that we collected the data and got it in, but I wasn't involved in dealing with the cleanup issues and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
What was being done. I did get involved with that very much at Grand Canyon, but at Petrified Forest, I was mostly just supplying the data.
Okay. All right. So what else do you remember on that tour with Chris? Other things that he might have showed you that he wanted?
We were talking about a number of different things. The air quality one is the one that kind of sticks in my mind because it was the thing that was broken that we had to get going. We were talking about some of the other issues that were facing the park. One of them was the concern about the theft of petrified wood. And I mentioned before, many interviews back, we used to mark petrified wood that people brought into the park because we wanted to make sure that they weren't stealing petrified wood from the park.
Yeah.
But the park didn't have a good handle on, just how much was disappearing. You could go out to some of the petrified wood localities in the park, and it was obvious that, a lot of petrified wood was gone. There's one spot in the park where there's a little self-guiding trail and that sort of thing on one side of the road, and a parking lot and a shade structure and all that kind of stuff. And the only petrified wood that you see, especially by the parking lot, is stuff that weighs more than about 500 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
But yet you go to the other side of the road, and the ground is completely covered with little chips of petrified wood.
Oh, interesting.
So it was obvious that the wood was leaving, but we really didn't know how much was gone.
Going.
Yeah. And there had been a lot of estimates, but nobody really had any background. So that was going on. We also had all the researchers that were coming into the park, and part of the, it was wonderful to have all the research going on and all that kind of stuff, but we also wanted to make sure that we were adhering to the collection principles and all that sort of thing, because you can't collect in a national park, you can't come in and collect fossils or whatever without a research permit, without a permit to do it. And there are some exceptions to that, like you can eat pinion nuts in a park and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, if you're going to collect stuff in a national park, you have to have a collecting permit.
Right.
The collecting permit allows you to collect and study park resources, but the park resources don't become yours just because you collected them. They still remain the property of the American people. And so consequently, the conditions of the research permit include that you have to publish your results. They have to be available to the people who the resources belong to. And once you're done with them, they have to be deposited in some kind of a facility so that other researchers have access to them, because they belong to the people. They don't belong to the researcher.
Right.
Well, some researchers are just, completely, oh, yeah, that's totally fine. And other researchers, it's kind of like, well, I don't know what's going to happen to this when I'm done. It's kind of like, well, let's give you some options, but it can't just disappear. And so making sure that we were adhering to those sorts of things was also going to be part of my job, and actually a fairly large part of my job. So planning, what do we need to be studying? What do we need to be managing? and that sort of thing, and working with the resource managers in the regional office, coordinating our research needs with funding that was available and what was going on in other parks and that sort of thing was also important.
Okay.
So we were looking at a number of different resource issues in the park, whether it was invasive plants, wildlife management. I was also in charge of pest management for the park. Integrated pest management was becoming the standard for managing pests, whether they were animals or plants. So looking over all that kind of stuff as well.
Okay. So there was a lot on your plate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was. I had mentioned before, when my phone rang, I never really knew what it was going to be. It was going to be cockroaches in the Fred Harvey kitchen, or a burial eroding out of an ark site, or a researcher wanting to come in. I remember one time I got a phone call. This was a little bit later on while I was at Petrified Forest, but it was Friday afternoon. My phone rang, and so I answered it. And it was a guy from it was U.S. West at the time, the phone company. And he says, "Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that we're going to be laying fiber optic cable across the park starting on Monday."
Said, "Wait, what
do you mean?" And he says, "Well, we're going to be digging a trench across the park and laying fiber optic cable." And I said, "No, you're not. You don't just come into a national park and start digging trenches. You need to get a proposal to us. We need to look at a right-of-way. We need to, do archaeological surveys." And we're going back and forth. And finally, the guy says, "I don't think you realize, but I'm the phone company." And I said, "I don't think you realize, but I'm the federal government." So the following Monday, instead of there were all kinds of idle threats as well. But anyway, the following Monday, instead of laying fiber optic cable across the park, I was working with the Museum of Northern Arizona for their archaeological survey of the proposed route for the fiber optic cable across the park.
Yeah.
And it was actually a fairly innocuous project. They were laying the cable right along Interstate 40. So it's not like the area hadn't been previously disturbed or anything like that. But at the same time, it was kind of a case of, no.
Huh.
That's not how we do things.
And it's funny that they wouldn't have gotten in touch with you early on in the process, saying, "Oh, hey, we're going to do this." I mean, clearly made an oversight, and then they said, "Well, we'll just tell them we're going to do it."
Well, and it was interesting because they did the project, and I could see, it was not that far from my office. I could see them out there working, but it was interesting after that, driving into Flagstaff along I-40. And you'd be driving along and driving along and driving along. And then if you were watching, and once I noticed it, I started paying attention. Periodically, this fiber optic cable would pop up out of the ground and be just kind of zip-tied or whatever to the fence posts on the right-of-way fence on the interstate for maybe a mile or maybe 2 miles. And then it would dive back down into the ground and it would disappear, and then 15 miles further on down, it would pop back up again and be running along the fence lines. It's kind of, okay, so, they just thought that they could come out here with a ditch witch and put this whole thing in, but it looks like I'm not the only, quote-unquote, property owner that had some issues with their...
Interesting, yeah.
Their approach.
Yeah, huh. What did you come up with as a creative way to deal to assess or try to get a handle on the loss of petrified wood from the park?
Oh, that was kind of amusing. We did a I went back to my old wildlife management class that I took in college, and I decided to do a mark recapture study. So what we did was we I'd mentioned before we would go out and we would collect the petrified wood that people pitched out of their cars as
Right.
they were coming into the entrance station. So we had a supply of petrified wood. And so we went out and we got some chunks of petrified wood, you know, maybe, as I recall, they were like maybe the size of your thumb to maybe a quarter that size. But we'd go out and we'd get like 100 of these things or something. I don't remember the exact number. And then we got some ultraviolet lacquer. It was clear lacquer, but it would shine in ultraviolet light. And we painted a, you know, just a swipe of this ultraviolet lacquer. And then we went out to some of the popular areas, and we set up a study plot of a known size, a few square meters, where there wasn't any petrified wood, or where we'd clean out the petrified wood. We put our marked wood in there and leave it out there for a period of time. And then at the end of the study, we'd go back out, pick up all the wood in that study plot, look and see how much of the wood was originally there, how much may have gotten moved into the plot, how much was missing from the plot. And then we would also go back and do the roadside wood, the stuff that people pitched out of their cars, examine all those chunks to see if all of our see if any of our ultraviolet wood was in there. And then if there'd been any what we called busts, where they'd confiscated wood from trusts, see if any of our wood was in there. So it was basically okay. Set the stuff out there, and I think we left it out for 2 weeks, but I'm not positive.
Okay,
And then come
not a
back,
long time.
not a long time, and then come back later and see, you know, see what happened to all of it. And the study had a number of flaws. Flaw number one was that our ultraviolet lacquer did glow under ultraviolet light, but after it had been in the Northern Arizona desert sun for a couple of weeks, it didn't glow anymore.
Ooh.
So I had an intern or an assistant or somebody was helping me out on the project. And bless his heart, he said, "Well, I can still see the lacquer. If I look at the wood, I can just see where the little stripe of lacquer is." And so he was going through all these chunks of petrified wood, to see if he could still see this little stripe of clear lacquer
Wow.
on the wood. And so that was problem number one. Problem number two was that people noticed our plots during the study, because there'd be we were going to places where there was no petrified wood, where it had all been stolen. There was petrified wood around, but we were trying to find a place where we could just scatter our stuff. And people would come in and ask. They'd say, "You know, we were out at blah blah blah, and we saw this kind of like square thing of petrified wood chips, and we were wondering, is that blah?" You know, it's kind of okay. So it's not a blind study.
Right.
So the long and the short of it was I had intended it as a pilot study. You know, it's kind of, okay, let's see how this works and see what we need to change. And so we saw how it worked, and we saw a lot of things that needed to change. But then I left Petrified Forest before I got a chance to implement to do a follow-up study
Okay.
that would implement some of those changes. One of the sad things that happened, though, was that you know, we did say, okay, well, you know, based on this pilot study, this is how much disappeared, but this is not an accurate number. You know, this is not an indication of how much wood is being stolen from the park. Well, somebody extrapolated it and said, well, you know, if it was this much from this much area, then from the whole park, we would be losing this much. And they came up with this astronomical figure and started publicizing it.
Oh, wow.
This much wood is stolen from petrified forest every year. And it's like, no, it's not. But that was one of the things that we did to try and get a handle on that. We also tried, you know, giving handouts to people, basically encouraging them to turn in other visitors, because people would come into the entrance station and say, well, we saw somebody stealing petrified wood at Long Logs. And say, okay, well, did you see him put it in the car? Oh, yeah, yeah. What kind of a car was it? Well, it had four wheels.
And it was green, and that's about it.
Yeah, and so we started, okay, well, if people want to report this stuff, we might as well get good reports. But we got, so we started having a little handout. If you see something, if you see something, say something,
right,
that whole thing.
Right, right.
And we got very, very negative feedback on that.
Interesting.
It was kind of like, no, I'm not going to, don't ask me to spy on other people.
I'm not going to rat on other citizens that are destroying resources, but I don't want to see resources destroyed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So that was one that didn't work all that well. And then the other thing we did was every now and then people would send petrified wood back to the park that they'd stolen. Stolen some, they felt bad about it, so they sent it back. And so then we started displaying the letters, and we'd block out, you know, who it was from and that kind of stuff. And what we noticed was that we did start getting more wood back, but we also started seeing letters that were obviously written to try and get on display.
Oh, interesting.
As soon as I stole the wood, my dog died, and then we got back from our vacation. My wife left me just before the house burned down.
Right.
Blah, 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 blah. You know, so it was kind of like, okay, well, you know, maybe this is working, maybe it's not.
Huh. It really makes me think of archaeological sites that originally had lots of pottery and maybe some arrowheads and maybe some grinding tools. And now I have nothing, because people just walked off with stuff. And unless there was really good documentation, which clearly there wasn't, you know, during the enabling legislation of the park, you know, aerial photographs or ground surveys or something, you really have no way of knowing.
Yeah, and they have done, since I've left, they have done work like that. They've gone back and done photo matching on historic photos and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And have found that, yeah, it's really bad in a few places, but it's not near as bad as, well, not near as bad as what we thought it was when I was there in the 1980s.
Well, like you're saying, you just walk across the street and it kind of buffs right back up again. And a lot of that's traffic control is where people are being encouraged to go, those places really suffer.
Yeah, and one of the things I found was we had when I was doing the pilot study, we had semi-random locations, but one of the plots that I had was in a spot where the trail was excavated. You know, there was a little hill, and it was a paved trail, and so they dug, you know, maybe a foot or 18 inches down so the trail could stay level going through this little rise over the course of maybe 10 or 20 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my plots was adjacent to that little cut, and none of the wood disappeared from that over the course of the study.
Hmm.
And it's kind of like, okay, so just even a little bit of being physically removed from the wood cuts it down. So what we need to do is put in boardwalks. And I was seriously campaigning to, let's put in some boardwalks. Let's test that out.
Uh-huh.
That would be good. Yeah. But I could never get funding for it. So.
Hmm. Interesting.
That didn't happen. But
okay.
So.
Well, I'm wondering if this is a good place to wrap up part eight, and we'll pick up part nine, kind of right in the same journey of things I learned as a resource manager at Petrified Forest National Park.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part eight, oral history interview with Carl Bowman. Today is November 22nd, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Carl, thank you so very much.
Sure. It's a pleasure.